This audio file is of Stan Jovanovic talking to a meeting at Chelmer Esprit in Dublin organised by the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You can find more audio files from the WSM at www.wsm.ie.
Anarchists and libertarians and lots are working in education, different types of educational sectors, and really we're interested in Stanley coming over so he could talk to us about his own experience of popular education and his own experience as a union organiser. I think the title was Operate Education at Time of Struggle, and certainly right now is a time of struggle. So I'm just going to talk a little and then we're just going to open it up to questions, I think. So over to you, Stanley.
I should tell you a little bit about myself, because it'll lead to what your subject matter is this afternoon. When I was, I graduated high school and was admitted barely to public college, to a college in New York called Brooklyn College. It was, at that time, there was no City University of New York. It was all separate colleges, and Brooklyn College was one of the colleges. And in the middle of my second semester, the administration had banned the student newspaper because the student newspaper had supported a communist youth organization, a student organization, which had been banned from campus. It was during the McCarthy period, bedtime. And I signed a statement along with seven others, because at that time I was the president of a club. I signed a statement urging students to sit in at the dean of students' office and 400 students, whatever. And all of the people who signed the statement, the eight of us, were suspended for conduct unbecoming a student. So I've been unbecoming almost all of my life. But therein lies a tale, and the tale is that for the next 15 years, I spent 10 years in steel mill, two of them, and 7 years, the next 17 years, as a full-time union organizer. First for the Clothing Workers Union, and then for the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union. And in the middle of, I was active in the plant. I was a grievance chair. And in the middle of my, from the time that I actually began to be active in the unions to the time that I decided that I had enough of union, full-time union work, I was continually charged with being a communist. And in some cases, I was actually—I never got fired by the company, but I was at one point when I was when I worked for the oil chemical workers, I was brought up because the a nationally syndicated columnist whose name is not important, he's been justly forgotten, except by me and a few other people, wrote a nationally syndicated column calling me the leader of the communist conspiracy in the labor movement. And that was fun. And the reason was because I was an open, active campaigner against the war in Vietnam. And then the union got very upset, and so they had a series of meetings, and I had a standard answer. And my answer was that I'm not a communist because the Communist Party is too conservative. Well, that was true on the one hand. On the other hand, that was a shocking revelation for working people who were very the Oil Chemical Union, which no longer exists, is now the Steelworkers Union. Very democratic union. Most of the decisions were made by rank and file boards. You know, there's not a heavy bureaucracy. And when I sat before these people who knew me, and I said, you know, they're not radical. The communists are playing games and all that kind of stuff, and the Soviet Union's a crock of shit and all that. That was persuasive to people because they wanted to hear that I was not part of this apparatus that they were upset about, and to a certain extent they had some justification. In many cases they didn't. And then when I decided for a variety of reasons that I was no longer going to be a member of the staff of the oil chemical workers, I had been I organized atomic workers, people who made atomic energy, not bombs. I organized chemical workers. I organized miners. I was in New Mexico and organized a molybdenum mine, which is part of the one of the elements of nuclear stuff. And I also was running around and was I was the Caribbean director for the union because they exiled me after this incident about my communism. They didn't fire me. They were very, very good. And if they had fired me, I think they would have had trouble in the district that I worked in, which was the northeastern district and the largest district in the union. But I had young kids, and I was already having serious doubts that being a full-time union representative was any good. It was not a good place to be because I wasn't elected, and because I was on a staff, and I was subject to all this foolishness. And so my kids were saying, "We never see you," and I left. At that point, I decided that I wanted to write about the labor movement. And so what I did is I went. Somebody who was a professor at the New School for Social Research, I don't know whether you know what that is. Anybody know what that is? You do. The New School was a college that a university, actually not a university, it was a college that was established in 1915 as a protest against traditional higher education in the United States, and gradually got more and more and more conservative, I mean more traditional itself. But they did have at that point certain practices in the early 70s. And the practice that they had, which was late 60s, early 70s, was that they made allowances for people like me who were no longer of college age but had done certain things plus had done some writing. I had done some writing, which was published writing. They gave me a bachelor's degree for writing a paper. Well, I had taken the exams, which were the graduate record exams, and I had done pretty well, and decided to give me the degree if I went to their graduate school. And so I went to the graduate school in sociology, and for the first semester I had a good time because I had a lot of Germans. I actually had a course. I actually sat in Habermas's course and things like that, and he was much better than he is now, than he became. But when I had to face American sociology, I quit again. And so, this was me, you know, this is who I am and was and so on. And what I did then is become a community organizer for a youth agency on the Lower East Side of New York called the Mobilization Youth. And then my first experience, major experience actually, important experience aside from organizing, which is always in me of education, this is always popular education, and I can talk about that in a minute. I was offered a job to help organize the first experimental public high school in the city of New York since the war, I guess. I mean, or maybe even before the war. There were some good high schools before the war, but basically, since the war, the experimentation had died, and they decided to do it again. And the reason they decided to do it again in 1970 was because there was a black and Latino upheaval in the city of New York. There was a big anti-war movement. There was a lot of activity. And the parents in East Harlem, which was largely a Latino ghetto, were demanding that their kids have an opportunity to go to a school that was controlled by parents to a certain extent. But they didn't know how to do the school. They didn't know how to organize the school. And besides of which, the Board of Education, they didn't want to organize an alternative private school. I want to say parenthetically, I have to put this in parentheses. We had a long experience in the United States, which has been written up in a book, which probably most of you are not aware of. It's a book by a man by the name of Paul Average called... You got it there?
I think it is.
You're kidding. The Modern School Movement?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my God. Oh, no, I know the book. Oh, that's great. Paul Average was a colleague of mine at CUNY later on, and we used to drink together. He's no longer alive, and he's the leading anarchist historian in the United States, and still is his work. This was an interesting book. But these parents were not... We had this long experience of anarchist and communist... He doesn't talk about the communist group, but anarchist and communist organized schools that were outside of the public education system. And there are famous ones and not so famous ones. The Walden School, one of them is called the Little Red Schoolhouse, which is still in existence. The Walden School is in existence, and many others in New Jersey and places like that. And these parents who were working class parents were not going to organize an anarchist, a school outside the system. They didn't, A, have the money, B, they didn't have the vision. So they wanted to do something within the framework of the public education system, which would mean still free public education. Because all the alternative schools, even today we have some alternative schools, they cost a lot of money. I mean, they have to be supported literally by tuition. And I became one of the two directors of the school. And one of the reasons they wanted me to do it is because of my union experience. And they thought I knew something about organizing, which happened to be true. I knew something about organizing. I knew how to do things. I knew how to negotiate, too, which is a really important skill. Even though the reason the school came into existence was because not of negotiating, it came into existence because there were movements, but you still had to negotiate the terms. So for 2 years I put together, you don't have to shut up the kids, I'm used to it. And so we did the school, and I have to say this, it's something of a point of pride. This was the first, but not the last, within the public school system. We now have, in the city of New York, a small school movement. This school had 150, it now has 600 students, but it started with 150 students, black, Latino, and white, from the two neighborhoods, East Harlem and Yorkville, on the east side of Manhattan. And now we have literally tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but tens of thousands of kids in small schools. in alternatives within the public education system. It was, and still is, a very important moment in the development of public education in New York, that parents and teachers, the one that I helped to organize was not a teacher's initiative, but in other cases, teachers got the point and they started to ask, we want different kinds of schools. The fights were always about how much the central board and its rules and regulations would be required of the alternative smaller schools. And the fights were, and continue to be, very, very, very fierce. They died down, and then they rise up, and they died down. Because the problem is that it's one thing to have a small school that is ostensibly teacher-parent, but in most cases teacher-run. But there's issues of curriculum. There's issues of whether you have to conform to the testing regime of the school system, and selection of teachers and selection of administrators. The reason our school became just an ordinary school is because they required, and the parents submitted to the demand by the authorities, that the principal of the school be from the list of approved principals, people who had passed the test and were qualified to be principals. And by and large, in the city of New York and the state of New York and the United States of America, once you have become a principal of a public school or a private school, with some always, I always will say this, stipulate this, with some exceptions, you're no fucking good. You've been so, acculturated to the system that you really can't seriously break away and do things that are absolutely necessary for the kids' welfare and do stuff that's good. That was one activity of popular education. I will tell you about another activity of popular education that I was involved in. About the same time, I mean in the same period that I'm talking about, at least it was actually before, in New York and Los Angeles, around the country in the United States, people started to build alternative schools of popular education. And the first one, I was a teacher, and this is alongside of everything else I was doing, and I was on the committee that put it together, was called the Free University of New York. And we had a very different approach than any of the sectarian leftist groups would have, including the anarchists. Our approach was that if you're somebody who's a teacher and has something to say and are good and you're responsible and you'll show up and you'll, you know, do good work, we will not put a requirement as to your political pedigree, including market libertarians. And one of the most prominent market libertarians of the 1960s, 70s, 80s, he died fairly recently, Murray Rothbard, was on the faculty of the Free University. Nobody got paid by that. No pay. And we had places like this. In fact, right on 14th Street. And that legacy of... And I taught in the school as well. And there were some successors. One was called the Free Association. And the Free Association came out of a statement of Marx, which is, we shall have a free association in which the full development of each is the condition of the full development of all. So we called it the Free Association. And the reason we had to change the name of the Free University was because the state of New York said you can't use the word university. It was illegal. So we had to use words like association and this and that. that legacy continues. I'm associated with it. I sometimes teach there. It's called the Brecht Forum or the Marxist School, and it is not a sectarian and a purely Marxist organization, and not a Leninist organization. Oh, I have to tell you, somebody else who taught at the Free University was somebody called Murray Bookchin. You may have heard of him. And Murray was personally an asshole. No, he really was. But he was a brilliant guy. And not only a brilliant guy, but a wonderful teacher. And charismatic. And he really, in many ways, at a time when anarchism was, and ecology, was to a large extent unknown but also unappreciated in the United States. He emerged through the Free University, as well as through his writings, as a model of somebody who really engaged in the kind of educational work that has influenced to this day literally thousands of people. I mean, it's really very inspiring to think about Murray. Whatever, he died a couple of years ago at the age of 81 or 82. He was irascible. He was defensive. I mean, there were many things. I got along with him because I get along with most people, and I just say, Murray, shut up, you know. It was all right, you know. But he was, you know, very, very frustrated about American politics and culture. But tremendously important, and it exists now. The Brecht Forum, or it's in New York on West Street near the Hudson River, and it is attracting thousands of people again. That is to say, 35 years later. It's been in existence continuously since the mid-70s. This was one of the continuations of this tradition that I've talked about, and I'm actually going to be at the Brecht Forum speaking on April 8th with a group of people, and you know, we'll have 100 people there, or maybe 75 or 100 people, and you can have a forum on a Friday night or a Wednesday, you know, and that kind of thing. And they have courses, and they have courses and everything from organizing issues they have courses in capital. One of my friends teaches a course in capital on a regular basis. David Harvey taught there and does teach there regularly. Combines his teaching there with his teaching at the Graduate Center, and he gets 60 people. You know, it's very, very good, very interesting. So that there is that part of the tradition of popular education in the United States. I'm not going to go on too much longer. The other part of popular education is in different parts of the United States today. And one of the places is in New York. There are institutions called workers' centers, which are not part of the official trade union movement. One of the more interesting workers' centers began in the 1980s and is today called the Taxi Workers Alliance. And the Taxi Workers Alliance just got recognized by the Central Labor Council. The Taxi Workers Alliance is not a union in the traditional sense, but they go on strike. Because, well, there's been a lot of debate within that organization. They now are negotiating, and I fear that may end their libertarian tendencies. They're now negotiating with the Taxi and Limousine Commission, which is the regulatory commission in the city of New York, for regularization, contract kind of regularization. But they have had, if not frequent, infrequent strikes about things like working conditions and about things like benefits and all kinds of stuff. And they had did a tremendous amount of educational work among 8,000 taxi workers, most of whom are Pakistani and Indian in background. And their headquarters used to be in the Brecht Forum. They had a room in the Brecht Forum. And so there was a connection between the general popular education that was being done by the Brecht Forum and the Taxi Workers Alliance, because sometimes people from, including me, people from the Brecht, who were people in the Brecht Forum, would give a class for the taxi workers about labor history and or a number of different kinds of things. I will tell one more thing and then I'll stop. I got this BA and then I got a PhD. And I got a PhD by writing another paper. I found a place, which is an accredited institution in the United States, called the Union Graduate School, and they gave me a PhD. The writing I did is with one of my books. It's called Science is Power, which is a whole other conversation. But I decided, after my union organizing and my organizing the school, that I can't write working 18 hours a day organizing, whether it be educational organizing or workers organizing. I just couldn't do it. So I had things to write, you know. And my first book is called False Promises. It's called The Shaping of American Working Class Consciousness. It's 450 pages. It's still in print after all these years. And I couldn't have written this thing if I was, you know, organizing all the time. So I decided that I would enter the academic life. And my first job was in a community college. And I did actually popular education at the community college. We organized a program called the Youth and Community Studies Program, and we moved that into the communities of New York City, and we actually did a lot of very interesting work. I won't go into it. I've got a lot. I go on for a long time, but I'm going to just say one more thing. For reasons that I can't go into unless you want to know, you want to know, I moved to California in the late 70s after having worked 5 years in community college. Community college is 2 years. It's an associate degree. Most of it is vocational. Some of it is liberal arts, but most of it is vocational. I worked in Staten Island, the Staten Island Community College, which was an affiliate of City University. And I moved to California after False Promises came out, and they gave me a job at the University of California, Irvine. And for reasons that had to do with romance and had to do with a number of other factors, I wanted to move back. So I worked at Columbia for 2 years, Columbia University. And in the meantime, something interesting happened. I'm walking down, this is literally true, I'm walking down the street, 14th Street, for whatever reason. I was living on 9th Street. I had a temporary sublet apartment. And I meet a guy who had actually visited the place that I was working in East Harlem, the school that I was doing in East Harlem. And his name was Joseph McDermott. You may have heard the name. Not the name, not the person, but you know the name McDermott. And Joe said, let's go for a drink, and, you know, I'd like to talk to you, what you're doing and all that. And he's the education director for a big Teamster local of municipal employees in New York, and they had started a bachelor's degree program at a state of New York college called Empire State College, and he was very dissatisfied. I said, "Why don't you go to CUNY?" And he said, I was teaching at Columbia at the time. He said, CUNY's too bureaucratic. I said, no, it's never just too bureaucratic. Why don't you think about going to CUNY? And as the night wore on and we had more Jameson, I took out a napkin. I carry napkins to blow my nose. I took out a napkin and I said, look, Joe, why are you fooling around? Let's see what we could do about workers' education. And I took out my napkin and I took out a pen and I outlined on the napkin a 10-year plan. Based on logic center of my experience, I said, look, we'll have an associate's program, we'll have a BA, maybe eventually we'll have a master's program, we'll have literacy, because a lot of workers don't know how to read and write. And so we laid it all out. And we negotiated from the union point of view. I didn't negotiate from the institutional point of view, because I was no longer at CUNY, I was in Columbia. And we put together a program for a center for worker education. The short and the long of this, and then I recruited most of the students by going to various unions in New York. We now have in New York 4,000 students in degree programs who are working people, and union members usually, but not always union members. And 78,000 people in literacy programs, and high school equivalency programs. So we're doing literacy, and we're doing all that kind of stuff. Plus, doing this degree program, I'm now on the faculty committee of something which is called the Murphy Institute. You don't want to know why that's the Murphy Institute. He happened to be a chancellor of the City University, very supportive of workers' education. When he stepped out from the chancellorship, instead of going to become a corporate executive, he went back to the ranks as a teacher. Joe Murphy was in the Center for Worker Education as a professor, and we call it. And he died in Ethiopia, and we in a car accident, and we call it the Murphy Institute. And the Murphy Institute has now. It's growing very, very rapidly, and it's got 1,500 students. And we now have a perspective which is part of the plan, but it's 20 years later. It should have been 10 years later. And that perspective is for a workers' college in New York. And real problems about it is that we're still faced with the same issues that we were faced when I did the high school. They want you to conform. You know, there's a whole set of conditions that they want you to live under. But the one thing we have in New York is, well, I'm sure, I don't know whether you have it here in Ireland, but we have in New York, in the City University of New York, a majority of faculty are not full-time. 9,000 faculty are not full-time, 6,000 faculty are full-time. We have 15,000 faculty in CUNY. I mean, you know, it's huge. We have 250,000 students, and most of them are part-time, and there's a huge movement among part-time faculty, many of whom are fully credentialed with PhDs, many with master's degrees, for justice. And in a way, that helps because it means that we have more flexibility. And on the other hand, they're not being paid enough, and they're second-class citizens, and a lot of those are the people who are teaching these programs. It's a labor studies program that we're developing, but it's also a program in liberal arts, and it's got a lot of elements to it. And I teach sometimes in that program as well as in the graduate school. I'm full-time teaching PhD students, but sometimes I teach in the workers' school, and I do a lot of work with them. I give talks, seminars, everything. But it's the first possibility in the United States of a workers' college. That is, I mean, you had Ruskin in England, which had a lot of interesting aspects of it, and the fight that I'm engaged in. The one that I have a lot of problems with, but at the same time, is to get people to think beyond traditional credentialism, because the credentialism is death to education. My latest book, by the way, is called Against Schooling. And the reason I'm against schooling is because I think schooling kills people. I think it's psychologically and morally a death sentence to go to school. To most school. I mean, part of it is out of my own experience. But to get beyond the idea that you're here to get a credential, to really understand a lot about the world, to actually take what your understandings are and put it into practice, very difficult, because the union bureaucracy which supports the school, the progressive bureaucracy, the better people, I would call them social democrats, you know, and they're all gaga about what's his name, the guy who's on the White House now. I mean, you know, and it's very difficult to move people under those circumstances. Well, give them a chance, you know, this kind of stuff. To move this kind of an institution to going beyond credentials, given the last period of allegedly economic prosperity, it was difficult. Now people are getting more critical. Because we are in the mid, you know, we're in the dumps economically, and there's no options for a lot of people. There's no place to go. They're asking municipal employees for wage cuts. They're asking wage cuts to the private sector. You know, it's very, very, very hairy. So there's a certain kind of yeast that's beginning to rise in at least in some of the big cities in the United States, Los Angeles and New York, among them. So the tests of popular education now seem to be more, not less daunting, but more possible, that we can do more of it and involve more people and so on. The literacy program, that's better, because the literacy program and the general education diploma, the teachers have a lot of autonomy there. They don't have to answer to anybody. I mean, because all they're really teaching is reading and writing. You know, that's what they're trying to do. So they can use whatever materials they want, and subject to student conservatism. Cultural conservatism, not political conservatism. So that's just a little bit of the stuff that I'm doing. I could talk about what we should do, but that's let me stop.
Sani, that we want to spend a lot of time just people being able to ask their own questions, because I think people probably are interested in things. So, people put their hands up and then. Do anybody else?
Thanks.
Everybody feels like one of those.
Do you have
pens?
Yeah, at the back.
I just had two questions. The first was about. This past week I was at a program in Scotland, in Findhorn. It was organized by a collective in the UK about popular education. And one of the discussions which came up, and this was actually turned into a debate, so I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on it, was the organizers of the course were suggesting, and they gave a whole range of historical examples, which they suggested supported this point in the literature of popular education, that popular education should issue in action. And the question that, that I had at the time was, you know, issue in political action. The question I had at the time, this is based on my own experience, I taught at Ruskin College for a while, and I taught a sort of fairly esoteric subject, I suppose. It was political theory.
It was not esoteric at all.
Esoteric in the sense that they would think it was esoteric because it wasn't issuing in, you know, immediately. And, you know, teaching, say, Plato to working people. And my question was, you know, what's wrong with teaching, you know, Plato to a group of working people? Why does it have to issue in political action? I just was wondering, you know, what your views were on that question. And the second question I had was, maybe this is a little...
Do I have to take notes?
You can answer that question.
Okay, so on the exam.
It's a note because I have to remember.
Second question is maybe a little at odds with the first one. And that's, we were very fortunate, we had a few weeks ago, Martha Acklesberg came to speak here at the Anarchist Book Fair. And she was talking about the Free Women of Spain, and she was talking about capacity building, you know, in the early stages of, you know, the Spanish Revolution. And she was making the point that it was called preparation for revolution, right? That was the phrase. I mean, I don't know the Spanish, preparation for revolution. And my question is about the relationship between popular education and revolutionary change. Is where do you see popular education fitting into revolution? Is it preparation for revolution? Is it part of revolution? How does it fit in your view?
Okay. Those are very, very, very good questions. And I'll start with the first question. Absolutely nothing wrong with teaching Plato, but that's not good enough. I mean, that's not what I'm what I would say. I think there's a I'm going to use the word the movement, and I'm not going to make any distinctions between people who consider themselves anarchists or socialists or whatever. If you're interested in a radical democratic movement. One of the conditions for the possibility of a free society, which is based on people's own power, their capacity for self-rule. I mean, that's what it's about, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Is the breadth and vision that they themselves, that people themselves have. One of the problems historically and to this day that we have in the societies within which we live is the division between intellectual and manual labor, where the experts in various aspects of knowledge occupy key positions in the bureaucracy, and people who are not in the bureaucracy have a very practical, a very everyday attitude towards knowledge. I think that's a sin, that division of labor. I use the word sin, I'm not talking about it in religious terms, but I'm talking about it in political terms. The major problem we have in changing the world, you can use the term revolution, you can use the word radical social change, however you'd like to talk about it. The major problem that we have is that we do not have working class intellectuals. That is not to say, you know, I'm not talking about anything specific about who the working class is, but we have seen the steady deterioration of the labor movement and the steady deterioration of the political parties attached to the labor movement, particularly in their dedication to the building of a cadre, but not just a small cadre, but a wide net of people who really have knowledge. And in the first chapter of my book, I'm going to get to the second question in a minute, but the first chapter of my book is of this Against Education is about my grandparents, about my parents. And one of the things that I say in there is that my grandparents and my great uncles and aunts were people who never went to school. Working class people, right? And they never went to school. And yet I'm using this as a metaphor, I'm not using this literally, they read Plato. They read everything. I'll tell you an interesting story. My uncle, who was the labor editor of the Jewish Daily Forward in New York and who had been an operator in a garment factory, my great uncle who was an immigrant to the United States, in the early part of the 20th century and worked at a garment factory, went to the First World War, came out, stayed in the factory, and finally became a writer, a labor editor. He didn't have any formal education at all. And we used to go to his house very often. My mother was brought up by his wife, that is my great aunt. Of course, her mother had died, and she lived with him. My mother, by the way, who dropped out of school at 14 years old. I'll get to her in a minute. But what's important about that story is that when I walked into their house, he had a lot of books. And one of the books was by Rudolf Rocker. He wasn't an anarchist. He was a right-wing social democrat, my uncle. I mean, he was a right-wing social democrat and a Yiddish writer. But he was a right-wing social democrat who read everything, right? And I'm a little kid, and I'm reading Rudolf Rocker. I'm 12, 13 years old, you know. He also had other things in the house, which I picked on. I had... and in that culture, when the unions, the garment workers union, the clothing workers union, were the vehicles of popular education, they had classes in English, because you had to learn English in order to become a U.S. citizen. And when the classes were given, they started with the Communist Manifesto. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you read. You know, and then you would read, you know, various things. And what we have today is none of the above. So that the problem of education is a problem of the empowering of people to be able to engage in the processes of self-rule, not just protest and resistance. If you're only interested in protest and resistance, then everything that I've just said is hokum. But it is not hokum if you really care about self-rule. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that, to answer this, is that the term that she used, preparation for revolution, was codified by Antonio Gramsci in the distinction between the war position and the war maneuver. And I've written about this, by the way, in the same book, by the way. The war position is the preparation, the period of the preparation. It is about struggles around reform, but it is largely about education. If you read Gramsci's prison notebooks, he's talking always about education. And that was because that tradition from which he came, he was general secretary of the Communist Party of Italy, but the tradition from which he came was a socialist and an anarchist tradition in Italy, which was defined in some respects by popular education, not just by the mass strikes, but by popular education. And he says, this is the period of the war position when we have to be able to cultivate a whole stratum of organic intellectuals who would be prepared to vie in the public sphere for what he calls hegemony. I'm not going to discuss that whole issue because that's a long discussion. So I'll tell you the concomitant of that. So I get to know a fellow by the name of Freddy, Paolo Freddy. Comes to the United States, I go to Brazil, and that's after, that was when I started this worker center. We invite Freddy to the worker center. We pay his way from Brazil to come to speak to the worker center. He was fabulous, you know. But I got to know him. And when Freddy discusses what they were doing in the northeastern part of Brazil, they were doing this preparation stuff. And when you read not just Pedagogy of the Oppressed, but you read his corpus, I wrote the introduction to Pedagogy of Freedom, which is his last book. And when you read Pedagogy of the Oppressed and Pedagogy of Freedom and all of the things that he's doing, you begin to understand that he sees education in the same way that I just described, as a path to self-rule. You're not ready to take on, you know, you're not ready to dissolve the state power by any means necessary, but you are ready to build a movement that sees itself as change agents in the world.
world. And if you're going to do that, then people have to have a broad knowledge of philosophy. They have to have a broad knowledge of the world and so on. Now, let me just say that you'll be interested in this. I have a book that I wrote in 2000, which is not only in print but being widely used in the United States, called The Knowledge Factory. And the book is about higher education. And it says the colleges and universities in the United States are factories. They're turning out people who do knowledge. And it has nothing to do with education. And the last chapter of the book says the following. In the first 2 years of college, students should be subject to no vocational subjects, including science or technology. And then I develop it's not a curriculum that is a prescription in the narrow sense, it's a broad curriculum, and I say they should only do three things, learn three things in 2 years, philosophy, history, and literature. That's all they should learn. That's all they should learn. That's all you should do. And I don't start with Plato. You should excuse me, political philosopher. I don't start with Plato. I start with the pre-Socratics. I start with Heraclitus and Parmenides and Anaximenes. I start with the pre-Socratics, the ones that Plato is always in dialogue with. You remember in the dialogues, he has a chapter on Parmenides. He has a polemic with Thales and all these people. He's really always in dialogue with Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Hobbes. You know, I go through the whole thing. And what's interesting is that I then got invited by several colleges and universities in the United States to meet with faculty about the implementation of the curriculum. And what did I face in the College of Newport and Puget Sound and one other? So I got invited three times. And is that the teacher said, how could we do this? I'm a chemist. I said, well, maybe you have to read. And it was that kind of conversation. And the problem was that they were defending their specialties. And of course, I always made the argument, not the argument, the quip. You know what the Greek meaning of the term idiot is, right? And they would say, no. And I say, well, the Greek meaning of the term idiot is specialist. That's my answer.
Why don't you look at me suddenly when you say that?
Anybody else? Finger.
I'm sorry, you have to speak a little louder.
In popular education, and when you're viewing education as a tool for medical development movements, I think people involved in education can challenge what's happened over the last, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years, where the language we use is being incredibly codified. If I see the thing that I understand about archaeology, where they use leadership content language to make, I think, from what I can see, is that academics use it to make themselves quite intelligent with more complex words to describe quite a simple idea. But that is going to be a problem.
I don't have any problem. That's true. Well, and your question?
How can that be challenged on a teacher? Because if it's going, if you talk to people coming out of that, where does that problem that lie?
Well, I think you challenge it in two ways. One is that you have to educate the educators. I mean, people who are interested in popular education have to dedicate themselves to speaking in a language which is intelligible. Is that right? I mean, that's really part of the problem. The second thing is that is the writing. If people are using text, there's a very good example of this, and it's imperfect. I want to just say that. When the open university in England began. The people who started the Open University, which was a kind of alternative to Birmingham, to Leeds, to Oxford, to Cambridge, to traditional academia, when they decided that they were going to reach out much well beyond those who were the 20% of the population that qualified for higher education, that they would have to write their own texts. They have to write, in other words, in addition to the reading, I mean, Plato is very simple, isn't it? I mean, the writing is never, the translations anyway, the Jewett translations and the Barnes translations, they're very not, that you realize that he spoke in pretty plain language, and so did Aristotle. One of the codes of the elite are always in complexity which is not necessary often, right? So you have to rewrite stuff. And it doesn't mean writing down at all. It means writing in a much more plain style. I want to just give you an illustration. In my book, and I tried this, and I'm going to just read two sentences. This guy actually has read this goddamn book.
He told me to. No, they're not my notes.
This is not the right one. Just give me a second. All right. This is the opening paragraph of a very theoretical chapter called Time and Space in Class Theory that I wrote. It took me, to write this paragraph, it took me 6 weeks. I'm serious.
Sounds like my work rate.
What? What'd you say?
It looked like my work rate.
Well, but then it flowed because I got into the flow. It was wrong and wrong. Classes are historical and their effects are intertwined with their historicity. I explained that later. Saying classes are historical means that their composition changes at every level of the social structure, ruling groups as well as subordinate groups. Classes form when they make historical difference. In one period, the military is integrated in the ruling circles and for a time may be the dominant partner. In another, it is plainly subordinate to the economic and political directorate. For the past century, as C. Wright Mills has pointed out, the one-time cultural and political heart of the American nation, the old middle class of small manufacturers and owners of real estate, a retail establishment, has been relegated to the middle levels of power. Their power and influence have been even further restricted in years following Mills' discovery in mid-1960s. Since the late 19th century, the leading circles of power have been constituted in the main by large corporations, the institutional form of capital, and the national political directive. That's simple. That's not complicated. But it took a long time to write that. And therefore, one of the problems is to write texts which are not simplifications, but are explications of certain ideas without the kind of academic jargon that turns people off. But at the same time, at a certain point, people who begin to read on a regular basis begin to decipher those kinds of complexities. So you do not say, do not read this and do not read that, but you don't start off by reading a lot of that stuff. The other technique, I'm a teacher, I really am, and I line by line. I always teach line by line. This was a talk, but rarely do I talk in class. We go line by line. I would take that paragraph and ask people, what do you think? What does this mean? What does that mean? And if they and if there's a difficult word, I say, did you look it up? And I'm not just talking about undergraduates. I'm not just talking about workers. I'm talking about PhD students who half the time don't understand what they're reading and do not look things up because they're embarrassed. They're embarrassed. You're supposed to know, but you don't know. So there's nothing wrong with looking things up. That's another way of doing it. And then you have people go around the room and read. I give you an example. I did a study group in my at the Graduate Center, last year in Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit. The first semester, that is to say September to December, we read the first 72 paragraphs of Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit, the preface, line by line. There were 9 people in the group. They met once a week, no credit. I refused to give credit. And we read it line by line. Now, when you read line by line and you don't understand something, there's a chance to, you know, to have a discussion. If you don't have a chance to have a discussion, then you're not going to get anything.
If we accept that popular education is encouraging self-management, if we accept that popular education is about remaking knowledge for self-management, we're with that, right? There's 2 things which you've addressed regularly in what you write, which I think might be interesting for people here to talk about, and which are preconditions for proper popular education. One is hope. Hope and vision.
Okay. Hope and vision.
And the second is a meaningful collective identity.
Yes.
Political collective identity.
Okay.
So those are, you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Hope and vision.
What are the sources of it now?
Well, we've got Obama.
We have hope. Keep hope alive.
In the words of my president, not this one, the last one. The radicals, as much as the conservatives and the liberals, in terms of hope and vision, are in deep doo-doo. Mm-hmm. We're in big trouble. And the reason we're in big trouble is because there are 2 reasons, I think. We're at an impasse. Let me spend 5 seconds describing the impasse. I believe, and I've argued this on paper, in articles and places, the era which began somewhere in the 1930s and 40s of the possibility of which gave rise to the welfare state, of social reform, is, from the point of view of the ruling circles, definitively over. They will not give concessions. Part of the reason they won't give concessions is because their commitments are much too fixed. The second reason they won't give concessions is because I think their problems are I think they're sinking into the drink. I mean, I don't think they know how to do that anymore. And of course, the third reason they won't give concessions is because the popular forces are not sufficiently powerful. But I don't think that would be enough, honestly. I think there's a lot of problems here. So the difficulty right now in raising the issue of hope and vision is that you have to be resolutely anti-capitalist. Resolutely anti-capitalist implies that you've got to really plumb for fundamental change. You can't fix the system. You can't patch it up anymore. It won't, you know. It's like having you have a tire on a car, and you patch the tire many millions of times, and finally there's nothing left of the tire. And so, but people on the heads are not yet ready to grasp that next step, which is got to take on the system, and it can't be just, you know, direct revolutionary action in the sense that the high points of the Spanish Revolution of 31 or the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 or whatever, Chinese Revolution. It's got to be that the fight takes place at the level of, you should excuse me, why aren't you having a general strike on Monday? And making that kind of fight. But that's not going to give you hope and vision. You've got to have a vision of what you call self-management. I understand where that comes from. I use the term self-rule, but it doesn't matter. We both agree on what it means. You have to keep talking about that. See, and what worries me about the best of the people that I work with, some of whom are students and some of whom are activists, like many of the people in this room, educated and so on, is that the slogan protest and resistance never takes the next step. Mm. And the next step is, what is your vision for a society of equality of men and women, of blacks and whites, of mental and manual labor, and so on and so on and so on? What is your vision? How do you see things going? And if you don't have those discussions in popular movements, if those are never the discussion, then you can't get anywhere. And so, you know, I would recommend two texts, just two. One is Rocker's Anarcho-Syndicalism, where he actually goes through a certain vision of what this means. I could name three. Ecology of Freedom by Bookchin, and the third one would be Ponikolk's Workers' Councils, which is published in England. You know, but I really think that that's the problem. People are not, and I don't like the word. I say this in this book, I'm not talking about socialism. I'm talking about rethinking how society would organize itself and how self-rule or self-management would take place. For example, what do you do about highly complex processes that have to do with sophisticated science and technology? Well, the only real way to have democracy and scientific decision-making and scientific and technological knowledge is that there be broad understanding of the main issues in science and technology. You can't do it on the basis of the specializations of science. I told a group, I was in San Francisco 2 weeks ago, and I told a group of postdocs, I was invited by a group of postdoctoral students in biomedical research, I said, in effect, you're idiots, you're all specialists, you have no perspective in the human body anymore, all you know is the relationship between alcoholism and the brain, and somebody studying alcohol. And I didn't get all that much slack. And I said, you're not educating people either. All you're doing is working in these research factories and doing mostly useless research. I didn't say it the way I'm saying it to you. I said it over, but it was really the same thing. And they knew that I know the science because I studied the science and I wrote a book on science and all this shit. You know. So the second question,
which is related,
which is the step just behind.
Which is how you relate the question of hope to the question of collective identity, and particularly class formation.
All right, let me say this straight away so that there's no confusion. People who call themselves radicals, anarchists, socialists, small c communists, whatever they call themselves, and do not have an organizational theory and an organizational practice, are not anarchists, socialists, or whatever you call them. What they are sympathizers.
You've got to be waiting for somebody to say that for years.
All right. In 2006, I wrote a book called Left Turn. And what that book is about is the question of organization. And I rehearse the organizational issues. Mainly is to try to start a discussion. Now we have a manifesto. We did a manifesto. Doing the manifesto in various places, including the Brecht Forum on Wednesday, April the 8th. People think, I mean, the people who are coming into anarchism think that anarchism means anti-organization, many people. And if you look at the history of anarchism, the most powerful anarchist movements, which have problems, all of them, no less than any of the others, that is to say, the movements in Spain, on the one hand, which is really the primary movement, and the other is the history of the Italian anarchist movement, you discover that they had strong organizations. The CNT is not a coffee clutch. You know, the CNT, the union, the great anarchist union in Spain, was a very tight organization, which doesn't mean it wasn't democratic. It was democratic and widely participatory at many parts of its history. But once you made a decision, you acted. You know, when you acted in a certain organizational way. Similarly, the Derrida column, which I know a lot about, that is the main anarchist group in the Spanish Civil War, they were motherfuckers. I mean, you didn't fool around in the Derrida column, you know. This was, you're in the middle of a war, you know, and the war was a, war is a different situation to a certain extent than kind of political struggle during ordinary times. But they were built on, the conception that they differed from the communists in that the communists was pretty much of a top down operation. They were trying to be bottom up. But once you had to have some degree of consensus. In fact, you had to have consensus in order to act effectively. You didn't have a vote of 4-3 and then decide what to do. You know, you had to fight it out within the movement. So the organizational question is always an important question. Having said that, it is very important that centralization be mediated by the federation principle. That is, the federation principle is that you have a considerable amount of local autonomy. Local groups can have the option to opt out of any decisions that are made by the collective. And the other thing is that you have to have ongoing collectives at the local as well as the broader level that really have continuity. One of the difficulties I think that is going on now in a lot of movements that call themselves anarchists, but for that matter, a lot of movements that are just movements, protest movements, is their episodic nature. The episodic nature makes it extremely difficult to have an effective popular education. So that to a certain extent, you have to take a look at and try to fight around the problem of bureaucracy. You don't want a bureaucracy which is a permanent bureaucracy. You don't want a bureaucracy which is self-perpetuating and so on. It's very difficult to avoid. But you have to have people who actually do the detailed work of putting stuff together. And that has to be done through delegation. And if you don't have that, you know, and you don't have all those organizational forms, then what you end up with is Seattle 1999, and then it goes into smoke. It really did. Anyway.
That's it. Just wondering.
Just speak up, sir.
Sorry. You were starting to get off to it a bit there, and I read some new stuff in where you talked about it. Just like, what do you think the approach of, you call it your writing to the party, should be to popular education? Should it be like, should they adopt like a strategy for popular education? Or
I think you can't do it without a strategy. And you know. Let me get this other problem before I talk about this. The other problem is linked to it. We had a great political theorist in the United States who's not recognized as a great political theorist, and his name is Thomas Jefferson. No, he was a great political theorist. And one of the things that Jefferson theorized was the idea of a party system. Now, he did it within the framework of the United States as a bourgeois state. But what he thought was that society should always be constituted, at least in this period that we live in, by political organizations that present themselves as alternatives to others, right? Now, if you don't have such a political organization, then the quote-unquote strategy of popular education turns out to be a professional activity. You become a professional popular educator, you know, with a credential and with, you know, all that. But if you have a political aim, if you have the vision and the hope for change, and you have something of an understanding of the way the world works in terms of the continuity, then you have to have a political organization. You have to have strategy. Now, the problem with strategy, there's a French theorist, French philosopher theorist, whose name is Sefto, writes a book called The Practice of Everyday Life. And in The Practice of Everyday Life, I don't want to be too esoteric here, but in The Practice of Everyday Life, he makes a distinction between strategy and tactics. And what he says about strategy is that strategy is people who think they can have power, and tactics are people who resist. Now, if you're going to do serious popular education, you have to have the hope that it is possible to actually vie for power. You may want to dissolve power. That may be the objective beyond the objective. That's the horizon beyond the horizon. But at the moment, you want to have enough power to be enough traction to be able to have some voice in the determination of events. And that's the only basis for popular education. Protest and resistance does not require sustained popular education. It requires anger, and it requires a degree of political organization and of social organization. But if you really want to do popular education, you've got to think about it that way. Yeah. And if people are going to be, I'm using a military metaphor, but it's an important one. If people are going to be armed with knowledge to be able to engage in self-management, if that's the goal of popular education, then basically you have to have a popular education strategy. And that strategy has to be really one that doesn't simply say, we will only learn that which is valuable for immediate political action. That won't work. People's lives have to be enriched. They have to feel the enrichment of their lives is what they're in the movement for, why they're going to school, or engaging in education. It makes you better people. Now, there's a lot of populist bullshit that says that doesn't make you better people. Western culture is all bankrupt and based on slavery and all that. I will stipulate that. That's all true. But that's not good enough. I mean, that's just not good enough if you're going to try. You know, I always say to students, and I have a discussion. I promote a discussion on this. I say, you know what? If you don't have the knowledge that those people have, they're always going to dominate you. You've got to not be intimidated by anything. I mean, that's the first thing. You've got to be free of intimidation. Reject ancient Greek philosophy. Reject Hobbes. Reject Hegel. Reject anybody you want to reject. But know them. Know what you're rejecting. And if you know what you're rejecting, the chances are, if you know enough, you'll learn something from that. I mean, I happen to believe that Plato and Aristotle, among others, still have things to teach us, and that continue to be valuable. But if you're always in a position where the scientists, for example, if the scientists say that the only cure for... First thing, there are no cures for cancer. I'm sorry. Forget it. No cures. There's remission. There's no... If the scientists say that the only tools that we have about cancer are chemotherapy and radiation and a few experimental pills, you know that they are bankrupt. Their knowledge is bankrupt because they don't take into account the totality of the human body, the way people live. Because their view of disease is always accidental in a sense. They don't understand the systematic relationship between genetic predisposition, the environment, and the emotional stress that capitalism puts on almost everybody. And that's cancer. They don't understand that. Oh, I had this discussion in San Francisco. They were, that kind of thing. And I talked about what the relationships were between those three that I saw. I said, I don't know anything, but I want you to respond to this so that you can tell me why would I suggest that disease as well as life is really about these three things. It's really about predisposition. It's about the context, the environment within which people live, the polluted environment, among others, as well as about the kind of stress that they face in their lives. And they couldn't answer. They couldn't, because they never, they said, Professor Ronowitz, what you're saying is well beyond our training. Oh. So, you know, it's but if people have some perspective, they can critically examine the kind of health care they're getting. They can critically examine the kind of environment within which they live. They won't be asking for policies of economic growth anymore, because policies of economic growth are creating the environment that produces disease, as well as produces enormous amount of danger for humans, as well as other life species. That can't simply be the property of specialized intellectuals. That has to be a broadly disseminated idea. And that's what the strategy of popular education really ultimately has to be.
Maybe take a few last questions, because we have to. There's somebody else coming in a little while into this room. Anybody else?
One question with the nature of popular education and variant popular education in particular is that it can only work in, like, it can only achieve its very success of, you know, people learning to read and write in a matter of weeks instead of months or years, when in a context of real struggle and hope and where there's already a sort of a mass movement. So, but if you need, you can't have a mass movement without having proper education, and the education isn't going to work without a mass movement, how do you start?
you start where you have the resources to start, and you know, theoretically you may be right. It won't really be successful, it won't be sustained without a mass movement. Especially if you're talking about popular education that's oriented to struggle and to hope. But what I've been trying to say is that they are relatively independent. That is to say, they're relatively autonomous. In the long run, you can't do successful popular education at the level of popular education in abstract. You've got to do it in connection with movements. You've got to do it in connection with struggle. But if what you have is a group of educators who want to get in, you know, who want to do a certain amount of work with people, you start there. And then what you say, obviously, is, and you hope that people will connect themselves to not only their own self-development, but connect themselves to ongoing struggles and become some different kind of people. I have to say this, that in my experience as an educator, I have been partly responsible or encouraging. I don't want to claim any determinations. Partly responsible for the emergence of some fairly important union leaders at the rank and file level and many community activists. But it did not necessarily begin from that organic relationship between struggle and education. It started in the, literally in the classroom, or started in various sites that are not necessarily connected to anything that you've been talking about. I think that it would be a real mistake if people did not, who were engaged in popular education, did not try to make those connections both in the process of education as well as to people individually. That is to say, if they saw only the intellectual exercise as a matter of self of cultural enrichment. But I do reject that the purpose of the education is merely to aid political struggle. I do reject it. We have as an obligation, not only an obligation, but should have a perspective that says the enrichment of people, the prefiguration of their cultural development is one of the most important aims, not the only one, most important aim to popular education.
Any more?
We've driven them into silence.
I think you've given them lots to think about.
Okay.
Should we just thank Sam?
Yeah.
This audio file is of Stan Jovanovic talking to a meeting at Shomra Spree in Dublin organised by the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You can find more audio files from the WSM at www.wsm.ie.